Good afternoon. So last time we finished up our discussion of some cryptographic tools. We're talking some about getting public keys to the right place. So we think of like a web browser. We thought we can use this idea of public key encryption and public key based digital signatures to communicate with, say, a remote web server in a way where someone with control over our network can't intercept that in a useful way. But to make that work, we need to get the public keys of all these websites we're going to be talking to, and that creates this big bootstrapping problem. So what we decided to do is we had this idea of a certificate that will have someone we trust to get the key of that website, who will get it, but to get it to us, they'll just sign this little document with a digital signature saying the public key of this website is X. And that website can forward that certificate to us, and using that, we can say, well, that must be their public key because I trust this person who signed this certificate authority who did presumably that verification step. And with our web browsers or our operating systems, they'll ship with this list of what are sometimes called trust anchors. So these certificate authority public keys that can sign things that we trust to sign other things, like be the identity of our website. We mentioned that actually in practice, for various sort of logistical reasons and the realities of this being done by multiple organizations, we'll have these chains of certificates. So we'll have a single trust anchor that our web browser or OS will ship with, and we'll get a certificate signed by that for another certificate authority, and that will finally sign our website certificate. And our browser is just going to get all of those certificates and figure out, okay, this was ultimately signed by someone who says I could trust the next person, and then that person said, this is actually that website, and therefore it's okay. We also talked briefly about sort of what actually happens to verify websites, and maybe it's kind of disappointing because the most commonly in practice, it goes down to someone tries to visit the website and hopes that their network isn't compromised while that happens, or their website isn't compromised. But that's sort of the mechanism we have settled on these days. So then we talked a bit about some other cryptographic tools. We talked about cryptographic hash functions. So hash functions have this nice property of kind of giving us a compact summary of data. It's a nicely randomly distributed one, but we want some additional properties of these hash functions to use them for certain purposes that matter for security. So one thing you want to use hash functions for is a way of summarizing stuff before we apply a digital signature to it. And why would we do this? Well, the primary reason is that most digital signature algorithms don't let you actually sign like a megabyte of stuff. They only let you sign like maybe a kilobyte of stuff. So one way of fixing that is to turn your megabyte into a kilobyte with a cryptographic hash function. But for that to be secure, we need it to be the case that you can't, have multiple things that hash to the same summary, at least not easily. Obviously, they will exist because, if there's 1,000 possible hashes and 1,000,000 possible documents, there must be some duplication. But we want it to be impractical to find. If we're thinking about the context of signing documents, we don't want it to be the case that if I take a hash of a document and give you the document I signed has this hash, we don't want someone to be able to produce a completely different and meaningful document with the same hash and have them reuse our signature for something nefarious. We also mentioned some other uses of hash functions, cryptographic hash functions, like dealing with passwords. And also, it turns out that there are some tools we can use to construct things like message authentication codes and some other tools we learned about earlier. Then we talked about another public key sort of style of cryptographic primitive. And this was specifically with the idea of we're not going to use public key encryption to actually encrypt things, we're just going to use it to set up symmetric encryption. And we can do that with public key encryption, but there are these sort of single purpose public key tools that are commonly used called key agreement protocols, the most well known of which are these Diffie-Hellman base key agreement or variants of it. And in those schemes, you have some private values that get turned into public values you can send to anyone, and you can combine someone else's public value with your private value to get a number, and they can do the same for their private value and your public value, and you'll get the same number. And this is a way of getting sort of a common number to use with symmetric encryption and message authentication codes. A common number, that is, that no one else will know, because no one else has your either end's private data. And then we talked about TLS. So TLS is the protocol that underlies HTTPS, probably the most commonly used way of sending things cryptographically. And we went through how does it actually set up a connection. And we mentioned that TLS uses this strategy that mostly it actually uses symmetric encryption and message authentication codes. But to make that happen, first it uses some public key tools to set that up. And we learned that it uses this key agreement idea along with digital signatures and certificates, so you know you're talking to the right website, and then key agreement to make a single set of symmetric keys that will be really fast for this particular connection. After that, we talked a bit about some other miscellaneous topics. So we talked about denial of service attacks. So when we're talking about cryptography, our attackers were trying to do things that were really powerful, of making other people believe the wrong thing and things like that. But often attackers have much more modest goals of just making things not work. And in that model, well, if they control the network, they can just turn off the network. But usually they don't have that much power. But they can do things like try to overload our servers or our networks. And, you know, if we look at this naively, we might say, oh, well, but that's going to require them to spend as much effort doing that as we do handling the load, but that's not really how things work, because there's these big asymmetries in practice where they can spend a little effort and cause us to do a lot of work, put a lot of load on machines in our network. And that's what makes it kind of hard to defend against these denial of service attacks. And then we talked about sort of one tool that comes up in defending against denial of service attacks and other things where people want to limit what happens on a network, and that was firewalls. That often we want to filter out what traffic can come in. This is one tool we might use, for example, to try to keep a denial of service attack from loading machines later on in the network. We can have a filter earlier, and these filters are called firewalls, and they're generally very configurable for all sorts of things we might want to do to limit what traffic can make it, what messages can make it on our network. So those are the things we covered last time. So questions, comments on those before I move on to our completely new topic. Okay, so our main topic for today is going to be, as I said, completely different. We're going to start talking about individual machines and talk about caches. And I believe I showed this earlier, maybe. So here, this is a die photo of a 2004 Opteron processor. I'm using a 2004 CPU because it's a die photo where someone has conveniently, you know, taken this microscope photo and labeled the parts of the processor for me. And also, it's a single core processor, so I don't need to worry about labeling each individual core and the parts of that. So this is a single core processor. And this processor, we have some space for the registers. It turns out there's a set of floating point registers, which are in the region labeled the floating point unit, and a set of integer registers in area labeled the execution units. And then we have some caches. We have these caches here, which are going to be what we'll call the level one caches. And there's a separate cache for data and instructions. And then we have this big cache here, which is basically half the chip, which is the level two cache. And this is an old chip, and the dominant design at the time had a set of level one caches and a level two cache. On modern chips, we often have, in fact, a level three cache. We have more layers in this hierarchy. And then, you know, ultimately this chip accesses main memory. In this case, this part of the chip here is labeled the memory interface, so this is where the chip connects to the actual memory. And the idea of having all these caches is that hopefully when the computation logic over here wants to actually get something from the memory, most of the time it doesn't have to go all the way to this memory interface and off to main memory. Most of the time it's somehow satisfied in one of these caches. And that's very good because the typical performance of using these caches is a lot better. So our registers are probably our fastest storage, but in order to use them, we have to write our assembly code very carefully to use registers as best as possible, or compilers have to do that. Then our L1 caches, I'm giving sort of very rough approximations because this really does vary between processors, but typically take around a nanosecond to access. And if we have an L2 cache, that will typically, on a modern processor, be something around 5-ish nanoseconds to access. So a lot slower, but not that bad. And if we have an L3 cache on a modern processor, that's typically like 20 nanoseconds. And then we have to access main memory, and that's something like 100 nanoseconds. As I said, I'm giving rough approximations, so I could imagine this varying by like a factor of 4 in either direction. But we have this big gap where our level 1 caches take about a nanosecond, and our main memory is like 100 times slower. And that big gap still exists on pretty much all processors, and that's why we have these caches. We would like programs to usually experience this sort of 1 nanosecond time and not this 100 nanosecond time when you're doing like a move that has to access memory. And what our cache does is, well, our CPU is going to, you know, that actual processing unit is going to make requests to this cache, and some of the time the cache is going to know the value. So in this case, we asked to read the address 1234, and the cache just knew what that value is, and it didn't need to send anything to the next level of cache or the CPU. But other times, the cache we talk to won't know that, in which case it's going to have to forward that request on and then forward it back. And when it forwards it on, what we hope would happen in the process is that it will remember it for later. So we'll record it for the next time we request that, so hopefully we'll not have to do this over and over again. And we're going to talk about sort of how do we design these caches to be efficient. And to talk about that, we should talk about like what's our goal here. And kind of the intuitive goal is that we want to get the performance of our smallest memory. And these small cache memories give us this sort of 1 nanosecond-ish latency. So that's the performance we want the program to see when it accesses memory. But we want the program to still be able to be written as if we have our big main memory, which can be many gigabytes or terabytes even. And obviously, this is not actually possible in general. But we can get awful close because we don't have to solve this problem in general. We have to solve it for typical programs. And for typical programs, we can make some very useful assumptions about how programs behave that are going to really help us simultaneously achieve most of both of these goals. That we're going to appear to have the full capacity at the full performance of something which doesn't have that capacity. And the two big assumptions we're going to make, I'm going to call temporal locality and spatial locality. So temporal locality is the assumption that if a program accesses something now, it's going to access the same thing again soon. And the consequence of this is that to make our cache take advantage of this, we should keep things that have been accessed recently. And if we do so, we'll avoid accessing memory a lot. And a lot better than we could possibly do if the program was just accessing random values. We also have what's called spatial locality. That if a program accesses a value now, it's likely to access values that are nearby in memory. And a consequence of this is that our caches should store not just the value the program accessed for later, but also some values nearby for memory. And these are natural properties of pretty much any program you're likely to write. You don't have to change your programs to have temporal and spatial locality. There's going to be a lot of it already there, which is why your program's still going to work well with caches that, you know, aren't necessarily designed with your program in mind. But just if you write a typical program, you're likely to have these properties. And to see why, let's look at a function here. So here I have a C function to compute the mean. Probably one of the most straightforward ways of writing that function. I get an array using a pointer to the first element and its size. I iterate through the array, compute a total, divide the total by the length. That's my function. And this function has great temporal and spatial locality. So one form of temporal locality we have is with the loop. If I see the instructions that make up this loop, so in this loop there's like an add and a move, and maybe a move, that doesn't, and probably an at, a compare, right? All those instructions, if I see them accessed, and I guess they're going to be accessed again in the next, you know, 10 nanoseconds, that's a great guess. Because of how the loop works, you know, that's going to be very true. Now, not all the instructions have that property, but the instructions in this loop, which are most of the instructions we're trying to read from memory, as far as like number of times read, most of our memory reads for instructions are that loop, they're all going to have this temporal locality property. Our caches are going to be able to do great with them. We also have good spatial locality. If I see this add instruction at run, then this move instruction after it and the compare after it are likely to be accessed soon. And those in our memory are going to be adjacent. The machine code for one instruction typically follows the other. Yes, this isn't always true. Like, there might be a conditional jump at the bottom of the loop, and I'm not going to access the instruction after that. But for the most part, the idea that if I look and see an instruction being accessed, I'm going to access something next to it is true. So we have good spatial locality, which means that if our cache takes advantage of this by loading not just one instruction at a time, but sort of one instruction and a bunch of things next to it, we're going to get fewer times we have to actually go to memory. I also have good temporal and spatial locality in my data accesses. So total, I, and length are all variables that I access repeatedly. They're data values I access repeatedly. So if they were stored in memory, the cache would have an easy time keeping them in the cache and avoiding going to main memory to get them. Now, probably, our compiler actually takes advantage of this temporal locality and avoids using the cache by just putting them in registers. But if it didn't do that, it wouldn't be such a big deal because our cache would have an easy time taking advantage of that big amount of temporal locality. And that temporal locality is why the compiler could easily put them in registers. Because it was easy to identify, this is accessed repeatedly, put it in a register, make things faster. But if the compiler didn't do that, the cache can kind of dynamically do that for us. I also have good spatial locality, that if I see an access to values of I, then my guess from spatial locality would be I'm going to access something with an adjacent address soon. And that's exactly what's going to happen here. That right next to this, I'm going to access something soon. And that means that if I bring in into my cache, if I read in not just values of I, but also a bunch of things next to it, I'm going to have less times I have to go to memory, so my cache is going to be able to take advantage of that. And to get all this spatial and temporal locality, I just wrote the natural C code for computing a mean. I didn't try to optimize it for the cache. It just happens because you just can't help writing programs that have good temporal and spatial locality a lot of the time. So questions on temporal and spatial locality. Okay, so now that we know what our cache is taking advantage of, let's build a simple cache. And I'm going to start with building what we'll call a direct map cache. This is one style of cache design. So for my cache, I'm going to have a bunch of storage I'm going to use to store my values. And I'm going to divide that up into what we'll call cache blocks. So each of these cache blocks will have some amount of storage, and I'm going to choose that each cache block is going to be 2 bytes. Why am I going to choose 2 bytes? Well, first of all, I only have 2 times 4 bytes to work with, so I only have 2 times to work with. But also, I want it to be more than 1 byte because I want to take advantage of spatial locality. I know if I see 1 byte being accessed, probably we're going to access a nearby byte. So I'm going to take a little advantage of spatial locality by making it more than 1 byte wide. And here I have my memory, and I'm going to divide up my memory into 2 byte chunks, because that's the size of my blocks. And I'm just going to decide that memory is going to be in these 2 byte chunks, where we have the first chunk be bytes 0 and 1, then 2 and 3, and so on. And these cache blocks are going to store one of those chunks at any time. That's what we're going to store in the cache. It's just one of those chunks of memory. So let's say I want to read a byte at the address 01011. So if I look in memory, that is this BB here. That's the byte I want to read. What's our procedure for that? Well, I need to figure out first, do I have that in the cache? And I have a problem right now, which is that, well, I don't know what's at that memory location. I just know I have a bunch of zeros in my cache, so I need more information. So we're going to talk about what that is in a second. Yes?
Are we assuming that the addresses in the cache are the same as the addresses in the memory?
Question, are we assuming that the addresses in the cache are the same as the addresses in the memory? So in the cache, right now, we're missing indications of what values are stored where. So that's the next problem we're going to have to solve. So if I'm looking for this value here, well, I'm hoping that I have that range of addresses, that block of memory, stored in one of my cache blocks. But unfortunately, I'm missing the information to know if it's there and where it would be. So we're going to try to solve that problem. And in the direct map design, we're going to first have to figure out where would it be. And we're going to solve that problem by choosing exactly one place where each part of memory can go. This is what the name direct map comes from. So I'm going to give an index to each of the blocks of my cache, 0, 1, 2, or 3. And I'm going to say that the first block, the block with index 0, can store 0 through 1, or can store this 4 through 5, oh, sorry, 8 through 9, and so on. And how I'm assigning this is I'm saying index 0 can hold 0, 1, index 2 can hold 2, 3, index 1 can hold 2, 3, index 2 can hold 4, 5, and so on. I'm just going around in the memory assigning sequentially until I run out, and when I run out, go back to index 0. And why am I assigning in this order? Well, because of spatial locality. I want it to be the case that this cache can hold a bunch of adjacent things together, so I'm going to make sure that, you know, if the part of memory you're using is just, you know, this, that'll all go in the cache by using this scheme. And there's another reason I'm using the assigning in this way, which is like with page tables, where we did all our work by looking at parts of the address, that's going to be the same way this cache works too. Because I've assigned this way, I can look at these highlighted parts of the address here, and that tells me what index to use. So everything with a 00 in those 2 bits of their address, that belongs to index 0. Everything with a 01 in those 2 bits of their address, that belongs to index 1, and so on. And this means that it's going to be really efficient in the hardware to go from an address we're asking for to find which row to look it up in. So in this case, I look at my address. Those 2 bits are 0, 1. That tells me that if it's in the cache, it's this value. But there's a problem here. So one problem is that I just started out with my cache of zeros because I didn't put anything in it yet. and my memory has to store some value. So we need some way of indicating that I didn't put anything in it yet. So what we're going to do to do that is we're going to add another bit to each row called a valid bit, like in our page tables. So that's just going to tell us, is there anything stored here yet? It's going to be 0 to indicate nope, and 1 to indicate yes. So this is going to be an extra bit we're going to store for each row. So now when I do my lookup, I'm going to look up this index 1, and I'm going to say, oh, there's this value here, but oh, it's not valid. I can't use it. That means it's not in the cache. I need to go to memory. So I'm going to go to memory, and then I'm going to store this value here. Right? So I fetch it from memory, and now I put it in the cache for later. But I have a problem here, which is that I need to remember that what I put in the cache was this block and not this block or this block down here, because those are all things which would go in that slot in the cache. And that makes sense because my cache is smaller than my memory, so of course there are multiple things which can go in any particular place in the cache. I can't have a one-to-one mapping. I have to have some sort of many-to-less mapping. And in the case of our direct map cache, it's an n-to-1 mapping. So I'm going to want to remember that this value came from this block here. And probably the most intuitive way of doing it would be to write down the address it came from, which would be 01010. Right? This is the starting address of the block. So I could write that down in an extra column here. So that would be probably the most intuitive way. That is not what we're going to do, because we're going to save a few bits. So I could write that down, and that would work, but we're going to make some observations. So one observation is that all these ranges go from 0 to 1 in the last bit because they're all 2 bytes. So I don't actually need to store this last bit here. So I don't need to store that. Also, if it's an index 1, we know that means that these bits here were 0, 1. So rather than storing the 0, 1, I can just know if it's in row 1, that's 0, 1 there. So I don't need to store this 0, 1 just before there. And so what I'll end up storing is these remaining bits, which we'll call the tag. So I could store the whole thing, that would work, but hardware designers are going to be thrifty about using bits, so they're going to store only that tag because they know what the other bits are based on where it is and how big the blocks are. So we'll end up storing these tags. So the tag we store is this 0, 1, which is those upper bits of the address in this case. So from this part of the address. And that tells us which of the different blocks it could be. That tells us we have from A, B, B here, from this set of this addresses, rather than say this 2233, that's not what's stored there. That's going to be important. So if we look it up in the future, we can say, okay, I'm looking up index 0, 1, go to this row, it's valid. Then I check, does this tag match? And if so, then I know these are the bytes from that block. And I need to figure out, am I asking for the beginning of the block or the end of it? I can tell that from this last bit of the address. And then I know I need to get BB. So questions on our lookup process? Yes? So the question, by not storing the whole address, we're just saving 1 bit for entry. So in this example, we're saving 3 bits. We're saving 1 bit because we're not storing this bottom bit of the address, which is always ranges from 0 to 1 in each block, and each block always starts at 0. And we're saving 2 additional bits by not storing these 2 bits we use to determine which row it goes in. The question is, we're still storing the index, so doesn't that take up space? So what we're going to actually store in our cache is only the stuff in this box. The index, we're going to know because it's going to be physically located in the array at that location. So kind of like with an array in C, we don't store the array indices, we just know what array indices something has based on where it is. Does that answer your question? Yes?
So would the CP somehow knows that the, kind of like the base register for the cache, like it will know that somewhere in its memory, so it will know how to like index it.
Question, would the CPU, how would the CPU know how to index it? Does it have something like a base register? So this cache is going to be a dedicated special fast memory. So the addresses we're looking things up in would be only make sense in this cache because it's sort of a separate piece of storage, kind of like the registers are a separate piece of storage. Does that answer your question? Yes?
Is the cache always proportional to the size of memory?
Question, is the cache always proportional to the size of memory? So the size of the cache is a design decision the processor designer makes. And usually the design decision is mostly determined by how big can we make it and still have it be fast, which generally means it's going to be a lot smaller than memory. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so one way of sort of drawing a picture of what's going on with this cache is we're going to divide up an address we're looking up into some pieces. We're going to use the middle piece, which we're going to call the index, to determine what row of the cache we're going to look things up in. And our cache is going to be a data store that has these rows and has some way that electronically we can supply a row number and get out all the values from that row. So we're going to supply the right row number, and we're going to read out this whole row from this physical storage. And then we're going to do the operation of checking, okay, I looked up the right row, is the value there actually from the address I'm trying to access? So to do that, we're going to check the valid bit, and we're going to check that the tag matches the one we have stored. And if so, we're going to call this a hit. It's actually in the cache, we can use the value from that stored data. So, once we get the data, we're not quite done yet. Because in this case, I'm not requesting the beginning of that block of data, I'm requesting something in the middle of that block of data. And how can I tell that? Well, I can tell that because the address I'm accessing doesn't start after the index at 0, it starts at something higher. So we know that each of these cache blocks here, this data here, starts at 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, and so on, just because the blocks always start at 0, the way we set them up, because we started at 0 and then advanced by the size, so they're always a multiple of the block size, which in this example would be 4, on the previous slide it was 2, so since 4, they always start with 0, and here I have a 2 for those last bits, meaning it should start at this, it should be this B6 here. So then we're going to have to take that offset and extract the bytes we actually want. So in this example, I have a little mux that I select the right byte here. So questions about this process? Yes? What is the middle 100? This is the index. So in this example, the first row is index 0, the second row is index 1, and so on. So this is how we determined to go to that fourth row. Does that answer your question? Other questions?
Size of the cache being proportional to like the address size? Because if you have like a 64-bit address, you don't want a bigger cache.
So the question, does the size of the cache change with the address size? So the size of this data part and the number of rows we have, that doesn't need to be related to the address size. Because we can choose to have a really small cache for a really big memory, it just probably will be less often we'll have hits. But the size of this tag does need to be related to the address size. So if we have bigger addresses, we'll need bigger tags. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so we're gonna call each row of the cache a set. We'll see why we're using the word set, which sounds like it should have multiple things when it only has one. Well, because later on, we're gonna put multiple things there. But for now, we just have one thing in a row, and we'll call each row a set. Sometimes we'll also call a cache block plus the stuff, the metadata, you might also see called a line. That's another term you might see. Or a cache line. Okay, so we see we have to split up the address, so let's think about how that works depending on how many sets we have and how big our blocks are. So I have this address 00111111, and I want to split it up into the tag part, the index part, and the offset part for these three caches here. So can someone tell me something I can do to start doing that? So look at the cache block size first, okay? So we're told what the cache block size is. So for this first cache, it's 2 bytes. So what does that mean as far as how we split up the address? Yeah.
You would need one bit to represent a two byte block. There's only
Okay. So you're saying, if we have a 2-byte block, we need one bit to represent where we are on that block. Yeah. So if we have a 2-byte block, I can think of it as that I'm going to number the parts of this block 0 and 1. Or alternately, if I think of my addresses, they're all going to be, the places where blocks start are all going to be multiples of 2. Because, you know, I start at 0, then 2, then 4, then 6, and so on. So they're all going to be multiples of 2, which means they're going to have one bit that's always 0 for the start of each block. So that means I'm going to have one offset bit. So for these 2-byte blocks, that one offset bit is going to be that 1 here. And it's always that 1 at the end because we always, the blocks come from being together, so we always take that least significant set of bits for the offset. So then I have this cache here with 4-byte blocks. So how can we deal with that? So if we think of how we number the pieces, well, I need 2 bits to do that because I can number it 00, 01, 10, 11. So we need 2 bits to indicate which part of the block we're in. So in this case, we're going to take the bottom 2 bits of this address, and that's going to be our offset. Questions I did so far. Okay, so can someone tell me anything about the number of index bits? That's the ones which determine what row we go to. How many of those we need? Yes. If there's 2 rows, we just need 1 bit. This index kind of helps us with that. So in this case, we're going to take the next bit before the block offset, And that's going to be our index. And when we have four rows, we're going to need two index bits, as we can see here. So in that case, we're going to start where the offset ended. So we're going to end up taking this 1, 1 here as our index. And when we have eight sets, that's 3 bits. So we're going to take the remaining 3 bits before. And then our tag is everything that's left over. So we have a tag of 0, 0, 1 for the first case, the 3 bits at the beginning that we didn't handle yet. For the second case, we have the 2 zeros at the beginning we didn't handle yet. And for the last case, we have the 3 bits, 0, 1, 0, 1 we didn't handle yet. Question? Question, we don't really need as many tag bits.
So, like, I understand the tag and everything that's left over, but if you just wanted to differentiate, you wouldn't need it, right?
Question is, do we need all of the tag? We need all the tag because potentially we could store an address with any other combination of bits in that part of the address in the same place. So we absolutely need all the tag to represent that. So as far as, is this like using a lot of space? There's two things that are going to make it not so bad. So one thing is, even on this picture, there's not a space I've drawn for the tag and the value bit, and the value is kind of deceptive because this value here, for example, that is 32 bits versus a 3-bit tag. That's really not a problem. The other thing is that in more realistic processor caches, a typical block size will be something like 64 bytes. So even if the tag is like 60 bits, it wouldn't really be a big deal. There was a question over here, I think? Nope, okay. Are there no other questions? Okay. So we get kind of an overall picture that looks like this. And in each of these caches, the FF I've highlighted here, that's the data that corresponds to this address as stored in each of these caches. Yes?
So depending on the block size, so for example, for the 4 bytes block size, the cache would get the value starting from 00110, right?
For the 4-byte block size, the cache would get the value starting from 00111100. Is that what you're asking? You need the offset, what value you get it from. So I think what you're asking is, like, this is the block we'd get. And you're asking, where does that block start?
Yes, what would be the value?
So to figure out where this block starts, we know that everything in this block has a tag of 001 and has an index of 1 and has offsets that range the full possible set of offsets, which is between either 00, 01, 10, or 11. So these are the addresses, so we combine those all together, of everything in that block. So the first address is 001100. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's do a little exercise. So have a more realistic cache here. So let's say we have 64 blocks and 128 sets. So it stores 81,092 bytes of data. I'm asking how many tag, index, and offset bits as a first question. So who can get me any part of the answer to how many tag, index, and offset bits? Or tell me what the first step to do would be. Yes.
I think the number of offset bits would be 5.
Okay, so you're saying 5 offset bits, and how did you get that?
Log base 2 of the block size.
So log base 2 of the block size equals the number of offset bits. Because if we have n bits, so if we have 2 to the number of offset bits equals the number of possible offsets, right? So that's therefore the size of the block. So yes, log base 2 of 64, I believe, is 6, not 5, but yes. So we have 6 offset bits, and we got that by taking the log base 2 of our block size, because we know 2 to the offset bits is the number of items that fit in the block. How about index bits? Can someone help me with index bits? Preferably someone who hasn't gone yet. Yes, sir. Her. Okay, so 2 to the 7 is 128, so we're going to go from 0 to 127, which is going to be 7 zeros to 7 ones in binary. Yeah, so 7 index bits. I should write that not overlapping with things. And our tag is just whatever's left over. So we're going to have, for the tag, we're going to have 32 minus 7 minus 6. So then we have a second question here. What bytes are stored in the same block as the byte from address 1037 in hex? Which bytes? There might be multiple that are correct. Who would like some more time? Okay, so let's see who thinks A would be in the same block? B, C, D, okay, no clue? Okay, a few no clues. Otherwise, consensus, A, B, and C, which is what I got. So how do I figure that out? So here is this hex number written out in binary, and we can divide this up into our offset and our index, which is going to be these bits, and the tag. And in our cache, everything that has the same tag and index is going to go to the same row and have the same write tag, is going to be stored in that same block. So but this, another way of thinking about what this question is asking, it's asking what things have the same tag and index. And we'll find out if we do the same work for the other addresses that these three have the same tag and index. Sort of same tag plus index, but different offset. set. And this last one here has index 100001. So it can't be in that row. So it can't be in the same block. Another way we could have thought about this is that if I look at this address, I know that the block starts at offset 0 and ends at offset all ones. So I can determine that the block that this comes from is the block that has starts at address 0100 and goes to 0x103f. And that's because 3f is what I get when I put all ones in the offset bits, and 1000 is what I get when I put all zeros in the offset bits. And anything in that inclusive range would be in the same block. Everything else must be in a different block. We can't store it together in the cache, not in the same row. So questions on how I figure that out? Okay, so let's walk through what happens with the cache and or a more complete scenario. So here I have a list of addresses in binary and hexadecimal that a program accesses, and I have a cache here which has 2-byte blocks and 4 sets. So first thing I'd like to do is figure out how many tag, index, and offset bits are, because I'm going to want to look up these values in the cache and figure out if they're there, which right now is very easy. They aren't, because everything's invalid. And later on, where to put them. So to do that, I can sort of write out the formulas for what we're doing. I don't have a which. We can summarize what we did as, you know, so here are like formulas that are just derived from the logic we had of, oh, if I have so many bits in my offset, that's how big the block can be. This is just giving that logic again. We'll revisit this later. But following that sort of logic, I get that, I get that we have, in this case, 8-bit addresses. We have 4 sets, which is 2 to the 2, so we need 2 bits to determine which set we go to. I have 2-byte blocks, so I need 2 to the 1 bits to represent where 2 to the 1 bytes in the block, so I need 1 bit to represent where in the block we are, so I have 1 offset bit, and everything else is the tag. That means I can divide up my addresses like this, where I have 1 offset bit to determine which of the 2 bytes, 2 index bits to determine which of the 4 sets, and everything else is the tag. So then to evaluate these accesses, I'm going to start with our first access here. I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to look for index 0. I'm going to see if there's something there. And it's not valid, so there's not anything there. Can't be a hit, so it's going to be a miss. But we're going to try to have it be a hit next time. And because we assume there's temporal locality, we're going to put it in the cache because we think probably it's going to be accessed soon. So I'm going to load into this cache this entire block, which is going to have 0 and 1 from memory, at the values at those addresses. And I'm going to set the tag, copying from the address where you just accessed. Then we access address 1, and we're in great shape because we just loaded that. So we're going to go to index 0. We're going to see it's valid, then we're going to check the tag. We're going to see 000, yep, that matches. So we're going to retrieve a byte from here. And it's going to be a hit. Our cache did its job and made things faster. Then we're going to access address 63 here. It has index of 1. So when we try to access it, we're going to first look here and say, not valid. So it's going to be a miss. And since it's a miss, we're going to update the cache to contain that block. How do we do that? Well, we're going to read in the whole block, and the block starts at offset 0. Always starts at offset 0, so it starts at 62, because remember, when we divided things up into blocks, we divided up starting at address 0, so it always starts at a multiple of that block size. So we start at 6.2, go into 6.3. So this is the block we're going to bring in. Comes from those two addresses. We copy the tag and set it as valid. Then I access address 6.1, and this is a miss. So what happened here? And we're going to update the cache. But before we do that, we look at the index 0.0, and we check, is it valid? Yes. So maybe it's a hit. But then we check the tag. The tag is all zeros. But the tag of the address we're accessing here is not all zeros. So it doesn't match. So it has to be a miss. And we're going to update that entry in the cache, overriding that thing that might be useful later, but too bad. We only have one place we can put it. So we're going to put it in the cache. And like before, what we put in the cache starts at address 6.0 because that's the beginning of the block, always starts at a multiple of the block size. Then we're going to access address 6.2. That happens to be a hit. We go to index 0.1. We check the valid bit. Yep. We check the tag. We see that the tag does match. So we're going to be able to retrieve that byte from there. Then I access address 0.0. And that's a miss because when I look at it here, I look at index 0. Is it valid? Yes. I check the tag. Well, we just overwrote that, it no longer matches. So this is going to be a miss, and we're going to update this block of the cache to now have 0 and 1 again. Because we still have that temporal locality assumption, we're going to assume, well, I just accessed 0.0, but I accessed 6.1 a while ago. 0.0 is probably the better thing to keep in the cache, so that's what we're going to do because of that assumption. Could that assumption be wrong? Absolutely. But that's what caches assume. Then we access address 6.4, and in this case, it's going to be a miss, and we're going to load that into the cache along with the rest of the block. So questions about how I did this whole cache access process? Yeah. So the question is this second hit here an example of spatial locality being taken advantage of? Absolutely, yes. And we can see that if we made our blocks bigger, probably we'd have more examples of that. Other questions? Yes.
So the offset bits
don't come into play? The offset bits don't come into play while doing this. They don't come into play when determining whether we have hits or misses. So if we look at our diagram of how the access works, the offset bits come into play when we take that data part and find the part of it that the program's trying to use. Does that answer your question? Yeah. What do I call the section I have on the left and the section I have on the right? I don't know like a real formal name. I would just call this an access trace. It's a list of accesses, and these are the results of those accesses. And this, I would say, is the contents of the cache. Yes?
So is it just because of the small example that there's so many misses that when it's like actually used for much larger addresses, it's just significantly less?
So the question, is this miss rate typical, or is it just because of the small example? It's because I constructed this example to have interesting misses. And because it's small, a typical program is going to access more things than fit in this cache, so it's not a great cache for a typical program for that reason. We probably want our caches to have enough space for what a program accesses, in a typical small segment of code. Yes?
Wouldn't it be, beneficial if it caches, for example, a whole page of data at one time, given that it can, because of spatial locality, how the data is in the same page might get accessed?
So the question is, wouldn't it be beneficial to make the block size way bigger, like a whole page? So people try to figure out how big to make the block sizes and the number of sets, typically by doing a bunch of simulations to see, given a program, what would the performance be like? And typically they find that because of the performance trade-offs with like moving that much data, you don't want to have it be a whole page. And also because if you have your blocks really big, you can't have as many rows. Right? You just won't have space for that. And this is why typically we see block sizes in the 64 byte range today. And that's just because presumably the processor manufacturers kind of determined that based on how fast they can make a cache with that block size and how many rows and set, you know, how many blocks they can fit in it, that was a good trade-off. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's do another example of this. So here I have a different cache, and this case I have 4 byte blocks. I have bigger blocks. So first part, how do we split up the address, this address, this 6-1 address, into a tag index and offset for this cache? Someone tell me how to do that. Start with the offset. How many offset bits do we have in this cache? So people are holding up 2 or 3. So who thinks we have 1 offset bit? How about 2 offset bits? 3 offset bits. Okay, so most people say 2 offset bits. So we have 2 offset bits. So they must be our last bits here. How many index bits do we have? Well, we can kind of cheat on this picture because I can see it goes from 00 to 11. So that's 2 index bits. And everything else is the tag. And we could also figure it out with these sort of formulas. So there's our tag index and offset. So given that, question is, which of these are hits? And I would use paper. Question? Question, in my initial example, did the index bits overlap with the offset bits? By the initial example, you mean the one where I constructed the direct map cache in the first place? Yeah, so in this example, the index bits and offset bits do not overlap. We have 1 offset bit and 2 index bits. Sorry about that. Would like some more time? You people? Okay. Okay, let's see. So who thinks we have at least one hit? At least two hits? At least three hits? At least four hits? Okay. And that, I think, agrees with what I get. So I get exactly three hits. So let's see how that happens. So we have this first access. Nothing was in the cache originally. So we have to load the cache. So I'm going to have index 1 be valid, have a tag of all zeros, and we're going to load the whole block, which is 0 to 3 in this case. That means when I access address 1, well, it's going to be a hit. And that's because index 0, tag all zeros, I should write the appropriate number of zeros, and that's going to be a hit. Then we access 6.3, and we're going to go to index 0. We're going to see it's valid, but the tag doesn't match. So this is going to be a miss. And to make it work, we're going to have to replace what's in index 0. I'm going to replace it with now our new tag and our new set of values for memory, which is going to be addresses 6.0 through 6.3. And that means when we access our next two addresses, they're in that range of addresses. They have the same tag and index. So they're both going to be hits. Then we access address 0. That address 0 here, well, that's going to go back to set 0, but the tag doesn't match, so it's a miss. And to handle that, we're going to need to, again, replace what is in this first set with all zeros, and then we're going to load again 0 through 3. Then we access address 6.4, and this has index 1. We look at index 1, it's not valid, so we're going to have a miss again, and we're going to load into index 1 this new data, which is address 6.4 through 6.7. Questions on how to figure this out, or what I did in my work? Okay, so in our last few minutes, let's talk about some other things with caches that I alluded to but are probably worth mentioning more. So typically, the way caches work on a multi-core system is that each core has a separate level one cache for data and instructions. Why do we have separate caches for data and instructions? So one reason is that if something's accessed as an instruction, it's not accessed as data. So having separate caches generally won't, we won't be missing out on caching anything because it's not going to be useful to keep something near the instruction processing logic if it's accessed as data or vice versa. And also, instructions and data have different access patterns, so we can specialize the cache for them. And a third reason is that if we have a cache that holds both data and instructions, we want to access it multiple times in a cycle. And caches do that, but being able to support more simultaneous accesses makes the cache more complicated and slower. And typically, these caches feed into most typical processors these days for like desktop or laptop systems will have a unified, meaning data and instruction, level 2 cache that's for each core, and we'll have a shared cache that's a level 3 cache for all the cores on a chip. That's the most common design, not the only possible one. That's usually what we see. So there's actually a whole lot of caches on a typical processor chip. Okay, and now I'm gonna have a little interlude, which we're probably definitely gonna finish up after the break, on how cache misses interact with C code. So here I have some C code and some corresponding assembly. My question is, what data cache accesses does this function do? For instruction cache accesses, well, we have to read the move instruction, the IMAL instruction, and the RET. So there's three of them. But what data cache accesses does it do? Can anyone tell me about any one of them? Yes. Yeah. Scale factor. So this move here is a move from memory to a register. So that's going to be a read of scale factor. Yeah, so we have 1 4-byte read from the data cache to get the value of that global variable out of memory. There's one other cache access that's a lot more subtle. One data cache access, I should say, that's a lot more subtle. Yes? It's the return value, which has to be read from the stack, which is in memory. So we have 2 data cache accesses. And we would care about these being hits if, let's say, this function was being called in a loop like this. We'd really like those to all be cache hits. And what we could do to figure out how the cache behaves is we could figure out what those addresses are. So let's say the return address is at this address, and the is it that address I've written down, and the scale factor is this other address. Then we could divide those up into tag, index, and offset, and we could carefully simulate a cache to see how that works. And in this example, they both have the same index, so they'd actually conflict in a direct map cache. This is because I chose this example this way, but this is an example of why next time we're going to talk about going beyond direct map caches, because this kind of coincidence shouldn't it being possible is really bad. Right? It would be really bad if these two values kind of interfere in the cache because they go to the same set. So we're going to have a design that's going to help us avoid that. So we're going to want something better than a direct map cache. Okay. And I guess we'll start this example. I'll just start with going through one other problem we have this cache. So here I have some C code that uses an array. And let's say we have a one set cache, so it has one row with one block that holds 8-byte blocks. How many cache misses should we have? And to think about this problem, we need to think about how the array maps to cache blocks. And there's multiple ways this could work. We didn't provide enough information. What we hope happens is that the array is kind of aligned with our cache blocks, and this is something we hope the compiler does for us, and the compilers do try to do, in which case we'll get this pattern. We access 0, so that reads in a cache block containing 0 and 1, index 0 and 1 of the array. We access 1, that's a hit. We access 2, that reads a cache block containing 2 and 3, a miss and a hit. And so we get a 50% hit rate. So that's what we hope happens. We could get unlucky if our compiler doesn't help us have it divided up this way. So we're going to look more at thinking about C code and cache misses. We're mostly going to assume that the compiler does this first step for us, and then we're going to think about, well, how does that affect sort of slightly more complicated C code, just to help us think about what caches are actually doing. And that's what we'll talk about after the break. See you in a couple weeks.